Before we start today's podcast, I wanted to share a few things. Firstly, there are some really exciting times ahead. The RCR Clinical Oncology Journal will now be making waves within the Twitter sphere, and you can follow our new account with the Twitter handle at ClinOncology. I'm really excited about the plans the journal has with its new social media strategy, so I'm confident it's going to have a huge positive impact for the current readership and beyond. Essentially anyone interested in the oncology space. Second, I hope you've enjoyed hearing the first two parts of our podcast on cervical and endometrial cancer. We have spent quite a bit of time talking about the cervical cancer vaccine program, and in fact, since the recording of the interviews for part three, which will be within this episode, we've had some fantastic news about the effectiveness of cervical cancer vaccination within the UK. A study published in The Lancet this month examined what happened after the vaccine was introduced for girls in England aged 12 to 18 since 2008. Data from a total of 13.7 million years of follow-up of women aged 20 to 30 years has shown some fantastic results. The study examined both cervical cancer rates and CIN3, which represents a precancerous lesion, and significant reductions were seen for both conditions. There was a bit of difference in terms of the effect size based on what age girls were when they received the vaccine. If we focus on cervical cancer, an 87% relative risk reduction is seen for age 12 to 13 years at time of vaccination. And this is compared to a 34% risk reduction for girls vaccinated between 16 to 18. The age disparity is actually quite unsurprising because fewer older teenagers decided to have the jab and they may already have been sexually active. What's really incredible is that overall the study estimated the HPV program within England has prevented about 450 cancers and 17,200 precancers, which is fantastic news, and one anticipates this magnitude of impact would carry over to vaccination programs around the world. The author's interpretation of the study is a really heartwarming thing to read, and it reads as, "We observed a substantial reduction in cervical cancer and incidence of CIN3 in young women after the introduction of the HPV immunisation programme in England, especially in individuals who were offered the vaccine at age 12 to 13 years. The HPV immunisation programme has successfully almost eliminated cervical cancer in women born since September 1st, 1995. On that great note, let's start our podcast and remember to follow us on our new Twitter handle at ClinOncology. Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. My name is Saif Ahmed. In this episode, which is the third and final part related to our fantastic special issue on gynecological cancers, I'll be speaking with Dr. Alex Stewart, who was a guest editor of this issue and a consultant clinical oncologist at Royal Surrey County Hospital and honorary senior lecturer at the University of Surrey. She is joined by Dr. Jennifer Davies Oliveira, who first authored the special issue article on cervical cancer elimination and is a gynecological surgeon and clinical research fellow at the University of Manchester. Alex and Jen, thank you so much for joining us today. And I just wanted to start off, Alex, by congratulating you on the special issue, which is really fantastic. And start off by asking why you felt that it was a good time to release a special issue on this topic of gynecological cancers.
I think there's a lot of change at the moment in the treatment for gynecologic cancer. And we really wanted to focus on both endometrial cancer and cervix cancer. Endometrial cancer because there's some great advances in surgical technology at the moment. And there's some really exciting information coming out around molecular testing, the systemic therapies becoming increasingly tailored for the patient and their particular cancer. And so that is very interesting. And I think we're going to start seeing some great advances in survival and treatment. And then with cervix cancer, Again, the technology is very exciting, more on the radiotherapy side for that. With external beam radiotherapy and brachytherapy, we're able now to treat more precisely and increase the chance of cure, hopefully decrease the toxicity. But we also wanted to have a focus on toxicity, because there's no point in improving how we treat the cancer if we're not then improving any consequences of treatment. But then, just to start with, we also wanted to discuss how we can improve the detection and see if we can try and prevent these diseases as well.
That all sounds fantastic. And for yourself, Alex, as you were putting this special issue together, were there any sort of things that you really learned as part of that you didn't know before?
So hopefully I keep up to date. I think what I learned particularly was how much the molecular tailoring for systemic therapies coming along in endometrial cancer, because I think that is just improving in leaps and bounds, and that can be different from month to month. So I think I learned a lot with that. I really enjoyed the paper on ultrasound guidance in brachytherapy. I know quite a lot about it, but it was really nice to see it all succinctly put together and to be able to pass that out to other people. For the HPV eradication, I learned quite a lot in that paper, and it's really nice to see how the world is working together to try to eradicate. I don't think we'll eradicate cervix cancer altogether, but I think we might be able to eradicate HPV-associated cervix cancer, which is very exciting. And those were, I think, the main areas that I learned from this one.
Thank you. And just to bring you in here, Jen, then, you did a fantastic job of first authoring one of the articles in this special issue around cervical cancer globally and what we should be doing about it. Can you talk us through your experience, how you got involved, and how you then put together that article?
Well, I was very lucky to becoming a clinical research fellow with Professor Crosby in Manchester. And this was the perfect sort of platform to start looking at cervical cancer prevention specifically. And yeah, I'm very excited to have been involved. And it was a huge learning curve. And also because it was very collaborative across continents. Of course, there were challenges with time differences, et cetera, and being in the time of COVID as well, but learned so much from my colleagues and their area of expertise and what's being done in different places to try and eliminate cervical cancer. So it was a really fantastic experience, and very grateful for it. And I hope that your readers enjoy the article.
And we've already spoken to Karen a little bit around the article, particularly around vaccination. One thing we haven't spoken so much about is treatment. So did you want to tell us a bit more about treatment advances in cervical cancer?
So we did look at treatment, and obviously there has been some movement forward. Obviously, the mainstay of early stage cervical cancer remains surgical, with the later stages being chemo radiotherapy. But the surgical, from a surgical aspect, certainly I think moving forward, we're looking more at sentinel lymph node sampling instead of a full lymphadenectomy in early stage, so that we can reduce morbidity to our patients. So that's quite an exciting start to that. And then also we're kind of waiting to see what some of the big trials going on at the minute, looking at less radical surgery for early stage, so the SHAPE trial, for example, and very interested in seeing what the results are for that, and hopefully we can minimize morbidity without compromising on survival for patients in that area. And of course, one of the disappointments, I guess, is the LAC trial results, which unfortunately now the gold standard is open surgery rather than the laparoscopic minimal access surgery that was being done as a result of that trial. But obviously it's important to know the outcomes, and it's important to know if there are differences so that we can give the best treatment for the patient. But exciting to find out whether robotic assisted surgery will actually, what the RAC trial will come up with, and whether that changes in terms of minimizing, again, morbidity, but maximizing survival for patients. So I think those are the areas within the treatment, within surgical treatment for cervical cancer that are quite exciting and looking forward to the future.
Thank you for that excellent summary. And Alex, with the clinical oncology hat on, where do you see advances, I guess, both in clinical oncology, but also potentially in surgery?
So with one of those aspects that we have surgically at our hospital, performing robotic ovarian transposition for the pelvic radiotherapy patients, and we've had a lot of success with that, and that's described in the paper on robotics. And we've actually managed to have some patients who've had egg harvesting ready for surrogate pregnancies, which is something that really hasn't been possible for cervix cancer patients. And as I said before, one of the big focuses has to be on living with and beyond the cancer rather than just the cure of the cancer. So another focus is the paper that I was a part of, which is discussing adaptive radiotherapy. And I think adaptive radiotherapy is really taking the highest scale of external beam radiotherapy. And it's very intensive, but it enables us to make a new radiotherapy plan each day, depending on exactly where the organs at risk and the cervix are in the patient on that day at that time. And that's very exciting because that should improve our chance of cure and greatly reduce our toxicity, which I think is going to make a massive difference to patients. But the biggest challenge is how that kind of technology is going to be delivered. With only a few of those machines available worldwide, there are areas in the world looking at how they're even going to treat cervix cancer and how they're going to detect the cancer and get the patients to the hospital. And we're here with the sort of whistles and bells, just making the treatment as conformal as possible and the surgery as minimal access as possible. So I think it's a very, very exciting time for treatment, but we also have to focus on post-treatment and access to treatment as well.
We've talked a little bit, well, quite a bit about the advances in cervical cancer treatment, and you alluded to earlier with endometrial cancer around targeted treatments and things there. Is there much going on in this space with endometrial cancer around radiation and surgery? Or what are your thoughts there?
So surgery, again, I think there's some very interesting surgery with endometrial cancer. The robotic surgery has become very much commonplace, certainly in the UK, for endometrial cancer. Sentinel lymph nodes, again, in endometrial cancer becoming much more widespread. I think the role for adjuvant treatment has become much more precise based on the PORTEC studies, particularly the latest one being the PORTEC 3 study, showing us the role for adjuvant chemoradiotherapy and chemotherapy in patients that we've not really given that before. So we were often doing that for the stage 3 patients, but the patients with serous cancer having that. So I think that's very interesting. And then the next PORTEC study will be looking at the molecular targeting and how adjuvant treatment is chosen based on the molecular profile of the patients. So I think it's a very good time now for treatment, and it's a good time for more treatment. One of our papers discusses the challenges, though, because endometrial cancer is associated with obesity, and obesity is often associated with not being surgically fit. And the group wrote discussing their experiences with patients who weren't surgically fit and treating them with brachytherapy. And I think that is very interesting and useful to be able to explore how we can treat that. One thing would even be sort of the greater prevention of endometrial cancer, but that starts taking us really down into lifestyle and diet, which is probably a whole another journal edition in itself. And then I think the metastatic treatment with molecular profiling, with immunotherapy, I think is very, very interesting. And I think there's a lot of advance that we're going to be seeing in endometrial cancer treatment in the next couple of years.
Thank you very much for that. And Jen, the research that you're actually doing at the moment is clearly very relevant for the things discussed within the special issue. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the big issues with cervical, I mean, we know cervical cancer, HPV-related cervical cancer, is we could eliminate it through vaccination, but also through screening, which the two together should be able to do that. So we're looking at ways. Unfortunately, only 70% of women in the UK or of those eligible for screening go for screening, unfortunately. So we've got a third missing. And the question is how we get those people screened. So looking at alternative methods, because now obviously screening is looking at HPV primarily, this has opened the door for self-testing with PCR technology. And so vaginal swabbing has been looked at quite extensively and is equal to cervical sampling. But we're looking, so I'm looking, and Professor Crosby in Manchester, at urine HPV testing, which has shown the most acceptability to people who don't go for screening or for individuals who are eligible for screening. So we're investigating that, and we are trying to find out how sensitive that is, to see if that can be something that in the future people can choose as a screening option. So yeah, very exciting. And I think it definitely has the potential. I think now is the time. Technology has moved forward a huge amount, and certainly, you know, it's showing very promising results.
Thank you. Yeah, sounds really exciting, and wishing you all the best with that. You talked about some of the surgical options for cervical cancer and advances there. And one of the discussion points around the entire special issue is around sort of global equity and how we best make that happen. So from a surgical point of view, do you think that there are challenges in having the same impact all around the world with any advances that we make?
Without a doubt. I mean, I think that is a huge issue, is the inequality, exactly as Alex has mentioned. I think that's across the board. So it's throughout all the pillars. If we talk about cervical cancer and its elimination, all the pillars that the WHO talks about, vaccination, screening and treatment, it's across the board. So all of those things are really lacking in low to middle income countries. And that's where the burden of disease is without a doubt exponentially more than within high income countries. And I think mainly it's, you know, the infrastructure, and that is a huge challenge. I spent a couple of months in Western Ethiopia, and the infrastructure, it takes 2 days for some women to get to hospital to deliver their baby. So that's such a huge challenge, and you need political will, and you need funding, you need cost, you need, you know, the cost has to be covered. And also, of course, then how to get the patient or the person to go for screening or to go for treatment. And those things are hugely challenging. And we've moved forward a huge amount, but sometimes we just need to look at that sort of simple interventions to try and get some of these things to, you know, the user or the person that needs them. So that's a huge challenge, and exciting as well, to think about ways of doing that.
Thanks very much for that. And Alex, bringing you in on that, do you see sort of similar or any different challenges from a radiation oncology point of view?
I think the challenges globally are very similar from the radiation oncology point of view, in that the challenges are money and infrastructure. So the access to the machines, having the machines available internationally, And while we are giving ourselves half an hour to individually contour one patient's organs at risk and 5 hours to individually contour one patient for gynecologic brachytherapy, enabling us to treat, say, two patients in a day for gynecologic brachytherapy. I've visited institutions in India where they're easily treating 10 patients a day for gynecologic brachytherapy, and they don't have the luxury of giving themselves 4 hours to treat. And their focus has to be on getting the treatment in and getting it in as quickly and efficiently as possible. And therefore, their focus is not going to be on post-treatment toxicity and achieving the least toxic treatment. And also, when their money really has to go into treating those patients, then there's going to be less money available for detection and screening, in which case the patients are going to present later and it's going to be more challenging. So it is a big challenge. Delivering adjuvant treatment to endometrial cancer patients, if the challenge is just getting those patients to surgery, then the likelihood is that none of them will particularly have adjuvant treatment, so they'll have much higher relapse rates. And therefore, the surgery has to be as good as possible and as precise as possible if the patients aren't going to have adjuvant treatment.
Thank you for that. And putting you on the spot a little bit, having put together this special issue, Alex, if you wanted the readers to come away with potentially one message, but also one action, is there anything that you can think of?
I think that the main action that people could have is of screening and vaccination. Obviously, within COVID times, everybody's talking about vaccination very highly. But the HPV vaccination, we really do have the chance of eradicating HPV associated cervical cancer, and also greatly diminishing anal cancer and head and neck cancers, and that's absolutely massive. So I think that everybody has to be thinking about how we can ensure that all the young people get vaccinated, how we can ensure that HPV does not spread and we can see these numbers drop. And I'm looking forward to the end of my career of finding that cervical cancer is a rare cancer and wondering where the cases are, as opposed to at the moment finding that there are too many cases and I just needing to run extra operating lists to treat all the patients. And if we can screen them and catch those cancers at an earlier stage, then we're going to maintain young women's fertility and we're going to cause less treatment toxicity. So from the cervix cancer point of view, those would be my key messages for other people to take away and treat. For the global point of view, I think there's a little bit about modifying the treatment, how we can give the best treatment for the low and middle income countries. So while we are concentrating on how we can give the fanciest surgery with robotics or the nicest radiotherapy with daily adaptation, we should also be looking at running global trials on hypofractionation, on improved accuracy, and making sure that the treatment can be delivered quickly and efficiently, and hopefully giving a lot of evidence base to that as well. And things like the ultrasound guided brachytherapy planning, making it really accessible and easy for people to deliver image guidance on a much simpler scale.
Thank you. That's really fantastic. And Jen, I guess a similar question for you. What would you say is a really key action based on what you've taken away from being part of this special issue?
I think, I completely, I was nodding my head quite a bit there about vaccination and screening. And I think definitely now, with exactly what you said, with COVID and with everyone getting vaccinated, this is definitely the time to really push that agenda for HPV vaccination. And also on top of that as well, looking at testing, HPV testing globally or in low to middle income countries, now is probably the time to think about introducing screening programs, HPV PCR screening programs in countries that maybe don't have it or have very poor provision of it. Because obviously COVID has brought about this wave of testing and probably kind of forced people to think a bit more about that and to develop those skills and have that technology. And so I think now is the time to try and carry that wave forward and get vaccination and testing going. I think also just there are some other things, you know, treatment of precancerous cells is really important. And you were talking, Alex, about how, you know, we need to think about delivering that in as best a way as possible, sort of in maybe a one-off way. And certainly we're trying to look into, especially in low to middle income countries, where access is really difficult, trying to do a sort of see and treat type scenario to try and treat the cells so that people don't have to come back because that's inconvenient. So I think things like that would really help move forward early disease treatment that will then reduce the risk of developing into a cervical cancer. So that's definitely something that from writing the article and from the research and looking at the WHO pillars, I think it's really exciting. And I feel like we can move forward with trying to eradicate HPV-associated cervical cancer.
Thank you both. And ending on that really optimistic note, I just wanted to really thank you for your time today and sharing such insightful thoughts around the topic. Thank you.